Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
You're listening to Farming News with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hello folks, and you're very welcome to another episode of the Irish Farmers Journal Farming News Podcast. I'm news correspondent Noel Barden, and I'll be your host for this week, when joining me we'll have news editor Amy Ford, as well as news correspondents Declan O'Brien and Rachel Donovan. We've quite a bit to get covered off. This week was quite a bit of news. First off, we'll have the green light for 9,000 acres farmers. We'll have what the Director General of the National Parks and Wildlife Service had to say on its approach to restoring nature. Then we'll be going to more current issues with the possibility of penalties for farmers with land near turf cutting sites on commonage, as well as the update on the fertiliser market. So first of all, I'll call yourself up, Amy Ford. There was a bit of news to do with acres this week. It was feared that there'd be a bit of scramble for places and that some farmers might be left behind, having paid for an application. I suppose, what was the news that came in?
Yeah, Noel, I suppose this week, so there's going to be around 55,000 farmers accepted into the acre scheme. So we've had tranche one, basically, and tranche two. And in tranche one, which is also oversubscribed, 46,000 farmers were accepted in to the scheme. And that was originally supposed to accept around the 30,000 mark, and then to accept 20,000 later on in tranche two. So last year, you know, all 46,000 that applied at the time were accepted into the scheme. So that technically only left around 5,000 places left in the scheme, give or take, to make up to 50,000. That was the target set out by government way back when they were talking about this scheme. So in tranche two then, for the 4,000 places that were budgeted for and that we thought were going to be there, 9,200 actually applied for the scheme, massively oversubscribing it and hitting around 55,000 farmers. So this week, the minister has revealed that he's going to accept all 9,000 or so farmers into the scheme to bring the numbers right up. They found the money through the Department of Public Expenditure, despite there being consistent commentary, I suppose, from the minister that a ranking and selection process would apply and that only the 4,000 farmers would actually get into the scheme. So I suppose in one way, like, this is very good news for 5,000 farmers who thought they might be left without an agri-environment scheme for the year, especially in the West. You know, Glas, Reps and Acres are providing some key farm payments to farmers down that side of the country. And I suppose the nature of the cooperation project side of the scheme, there is higher payments available, which is really targeted more at Western areas. So anyone that has an eligible application will now be accepted into the scheme. There's no ranking and selection. The minister said that his department will be in touch with farmers in due course in relation to taking part in the scheme. But I suppose there's a couple of questions left hanging over it. Like, there was almighty pressure on advisors last time round to complete work that these 46,000, or at least half of them in cooperation projects, had to do by certain deadlines. So there was big pressure on advisors. We've obviously had the department's IT issues. They've had serious issues resulting in thousands of farmers being delayed payments, and they only started getting paid kind of last week and the week before from the scheme for last year, for the works they did last year, for taking part last year. Now, the department has said, and the minister will have said, that this will be smoothed out for the 2024 scheme, but time will tell. But it'll be interesting to see how the whole machine, I suppose, continues to work with an increased number of farmers that hadn't been budgeted for now in the scheme.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a lot of IT issues there. It's handy enough accepting these farmers into the scheme, but will they get paid in time, I suppose, is the next question we'll have to look to. And if we're to turn now and look at the interview that you've done with the Director General of the National Parks and Wildlife Service, the NPWS, there was quite a bit of news to come out of this. We've a couple of stories covering it off. It's on the front page. And then there's a full page dedicated to the interview. I suppose, what were the key takeaways from this interview for yourself, Amy?
Yeah, so the National Parks and Wildlife Service, for anyone that doesn't know, actually has a massive role to play in certain farmers' livelihoods in one way or another. It's responsible basically for activities requiring consent for farmers on designated land. There's around 35,000 farmers across the country that are farming under a designation such as a special protection area or a special area conservation. And these designations are there essentially to protect certain habitats or bird species that might be present in that part of the country. It'll come as no shock that the majority of them are located from Kerry down to Donegal and then over towards the Midlands and down around Wicklow. In the majority of the sense, there are pockets in other parts of the country. And the National Parks is essentially is the overlord on these designations. So if I'm farming in a designation, I'm subject to several activities that require consent. So I need the National Parks permission, essentially, if I want to carry out certain work in my farm. So if I want to put up a fence, if I want to cut a bush, if I want to spread a bit of fertilizer, I might have to apply to the department or to the National Parks to actually carry out that action. And then they either give me permission or don't give me permission. So that's just a bit of the background. So it does have a big impact there, and it falls under the Department of Housing. That's who's responsible for it. So this week we sat down with its Director General, Niall O'Donoghue, and he basically said that the National Parks is not planning any new land designations in the future. They don't envisage new designations, and he said it's not in their plans at the minute. I suppose farmers might look at this, you know, with weary eyes. Anyone that had land designated in the 90s or 2000 under Natura, you know, would have been promised that things will be fine. And it obviously they receive no payment currently, while there was payments for Natura land in certain schemes around those times. That's basically been flattened to zero, so that there's no recognition, I suppose, of those farmers farming those lands. Now, there is recognition in Acres in one way or another that the cooperation projects that we mentioned around Acres, a lot of those lands are on Natura lands or designated lands. So it's an interesting take for the Director General there to say that there isn't going to be any land designations. And I'd say that farm organisations and the INHFA in particular will have said that under the biodiversity plan, the EU's biodiversity plan, there's a line in there about the strict protection of land. So will designated land become further designated, I suppose, is the question I'd ask there. And then the nature restoration law and working that into that. If I have to re-wet my land, as you cover off yourself, Noel, this week in our explainer on the law itself, if I have to re-wet my land voluntarily or otherwise, that's going to reduce the stock carrying capacity of it. And is that not another land designation itself? So he said a lot of things. He rejected another assertion by farmers that it was party to the devaluing of land values through the designation process. So a complaint from farmers is that, you know, if they're trying to sell land, designated land that to another farmer, obviously they're going to be compounded by the same issues that farmer is facing. So the designation has devalued that land from what it potentially could get if it wasn't designated, if that makes sense to everyone. And Niall O'Donoghue has said that they absolutely don't dictate land values. He said, if anything, he says saw that land values increased over the last 2 years, and he doesn't subscribe to the idea that the National Parks devalues land. On those activities requiring consent, Noel, He said that he admitted that the activities are complicated and the consent process is complicated. And he's saying that they hear the farming community loudly and clearly around how challenging they can be. And he actually revealed to us that they're actually looking at the process of applying for them and around demystifying the whole process, so that a guidance document that they're actually working on is fairly close to finality. And I suppose just one other comment, Nolan, I'll leave it on this point. We obviously know that the state, through the National Parks, bought the lands at Douth last year, over 550 acres of farmland, basically in Meath. It's a UNESCO recognised heritage site, but there's also designated land on it. So they're going to start, they're starting to draw up the master development plan for the lands there. And they said they're going to continue to farm the component of it that has been farmed for nature. It's acquired the research from Devenish, the previous owner of the land, and they're going to continue that research. And he confirmed that they're actively looking at partnerships for the site, and they are in talks with Chagask for a plan for those lands. So it'll be very interesting to see where that pans out. And one final comment, actually, Noel, he also confirmed that they're obviously still looking at the Connor Pass in Kerry. And I know that Rachel Donovan here, our colleague, will have reported on that previously. So they are looking at snapping up that land bank in County Kerry. So a very interesting interview overall.
Yeah, and maybe just one other point that stood out. You mentioned Devenish there, those lands in Meath and the Connor Pass. Was there any more detail on the agency's approach to going out and acquiring land? So it seems like we're covering off more and more frequently that the NPWS might have snapped up lands in Kerry or Mayo. Was there anything in the interview on that side of the agency's policy?
Yeah, so last year it concluded around 17 different land transactions, the biggest one obviously being the Douth lands, and then also some smaller, more strategic additions is what he said. But he said that there's a property team in the National Parks and Wildlife Service, and that's very ambitious in what it wants to acquire. If the land is especially high nature value, if it's beside national parks, if it's designated or if it's in need of an intervention, and if it's unique from a natura standpoint. So I suppose you could say, look, they are going to be a player in the land market in certain parts of the country, but he completely ruled out buying productive farmland from a food production point of view, I suppose, if I can put it that way. They're not going to be snapping up, I suppose, more intensive land, I suppose, in the southeast of the country or in pockets of the country that isn't designated or doesn't have any, you know, that isn't designated or isn't mature land. So he's not going, they're not going after that type of land, but they are going to, I suppose, play a role in lands that are, you know, of a high nature value or that are designated. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out, I suppose. You have national parks on one side competing in one way for high nature value land in parts of the country, and on the other side you obviously then have dairy farmers seeking more land for the derogation. So I suppose that's kind of the land market, really, you know, it's an interesting one, and I suppose over the coming years ahead, and that they want to buy more land and the different competitors for different types of land, I suppose. No,
yeah, there's quite a lot going on with the NPWS and how it influences farmers and the land market, and there's plenty more reading there in this week's paper. Sticking on a similar kind of grain, I'll hit to you, Declan. Now, you were talking to Dr. James Moran this week of ATU, and he was talking on the nature restoration law and the funding need behind it, and how the nature restoration law might feed into CAP and future CAP schemes. I suppose, what were the key messages that you took from that?
Well, I suppose this would want to be prefaced by saying that this is just his views on it. Now, he is an advisor and has been an advisor on previous government committees in the area of land use and the environment. He's a senior lecturer in the Atlantic Technical University, or formerly GMIT. Now, what he's saying is, look at that, the lands that come under the nature restoration law, that farmers who take actions due to requirements under the nature restoration law, we'll have to get payments for those. I think that was the big statement. And he says those payments will have to come under cap. Now, obviously, this is his view. And what he's saying is his opinion, and this is in many ways could be classed as aspirational, because it has been a big sticking point with the farm orgs. Well, where's the money here? Where's the loot for what we have to do? And so what he's saying is a restructured of streamlined, rationalized cap with just two pillars. One is your traditional cap measures, which is income support and payments to farmers, essentially, for productive enterprises. And then in the second pillar would be an environmental, all your environmental actions and your climate actions. Now, that begs the question, where does rural development fit into that? He said it probably would dance between the two. I don't know whether the leader companies would be too impressed with that. But anyway, what he's saying is, as well, is that you're going to have a far bigger funding of CAP. You're going to have to allocate a lot more money to it, because you're asking it to go well beyond its traditional remit. And now, he wasn't quantifying how much it's going to have to be increased by, but he was saying definitely the environmental element of it is going to need significant funding. Now, that is going to be a big issue within the EU, because there are so many more calls for funding, security being the big one, and border protection and all that comes with it, and probably in time a defense budget. So he's just setting out the parameters of where he sees this going, and how he sees the argument developing. But one interesting point he did make, he said, because the nature restoration law now has been passed by Parliament, by the European Parliament, he says there's a legal basis and legal requirement for it to have a separate line of funding in the next EU budget talks, the multi-annual financial framework. And he says that had the bill not been passed, or had the bill failed in the European Parliament, it would have been more difficult to do that. But now that it has been passed, that is one of the follow-on consequences. So he says the conditions are there to make a serious play for additional funding. It's up to the member states now to come up with credible plans that stakeholder agreed, that meet the requirements of the state's requirements under the nature restoration law, and then quantify the cost of that and quantify the funding that's required.
There definitely is a storm brewing there for the next multi-annual financial framework, the next EU budget negotiations. There's, as you mentioned, a lot of kind of existing programmes or policies that will be looking for more funding, but yet we have this new nature element that will be quite significant. So,
As you wrote this week, and as you can explain further, like, you know, what does this actually mean for farmers? So that when you see the actions, then you can quantify, well, these are the resources, are this the funding that's needed?
Yeah, so I suppose we do have another bit of coverage. We got a bit of feedback last week that we need to go into a bit more detail on what exactly this will mean for farmers. So we do have that coverage this week in question and answer format. And as we can see, there is still kind of wide enough definitions there. It isn't clear right down to the last detail. But if we're to look at the examples of the restoration measures that has been listed in the law, these range from buffer strips and hedgerows to cutting out grassland reseeding, cutting down on fertilizer use, and reducing grazing intensity. So even just in those couple of measures that we listed off there, there is quite a large variation in them. Do you know what is the difference between maybe do you know, allowing hedgerows grow out a bit, or is putting in a couple of trees, right down to reducing stocking rates and cutting back on fertilizer use? So we're still none the wiser, you might say, as to what the overall cost of this will be. But as we have again this week, there will be a process starting as soon as ministers give the final sign off. And this is only a rubber stamping thing that's to be done this month. But then there'll be a 2-year period where we draw up the national restoration plan that's going to say exactly how Ireland is going to meet Ireland's targets, which lands we're going to look to meet them on, and what funding we're going to use to do it. So I suppose it'll be 2 years' time before we start seeing the really concrete detail emerge on how it will impact farmers. But definitely it ties into that funding piece that Dr. James Moran was discussing in this week's paper. And if we're to pull it back to kind of existing farm schemes and current issues on farms, Declan, you have another piece this week where it goes into quite a bit of detail on the issue that emerged on acre scoring and buffer zones being applied around turf cutting areas on commonage lands. I suppose it's an issue that cropped up a while ago, but it still doesn't seem to be fully resolved. I suppose you were chatting to a couple of farmers on this. What had they to say on it?
Well, I think primarily the big gripe with it is, where did this 100-meter buffer that has been introduced under acres for plots of turbary rights? But under acres, where you have plots of turbary rights on a commonage, there's now a 100-meter buffer all around the turf plot. And that means that there is going to be a separate payment, or maybe no payment, on that section of the commonage. Now, generally what the farmers are saying, these turf plots are not owned by the farmer himself. They're owned by neighbours, and they were granted as turbary rights to give fuel to rural dwellers. And what they're saying is, as well, is that you could have these turbary rights, they're not positioned neatly in one corner of a commonage. They're scattered across a mountain, scattered across a raised bog. So therefore, if you take this 100-meter buffer around these acre plots, which they're generally around an acre plot, what you do is you actually take them up to the area covered by the plot and the buffer zone, goes up as high as 13-14 acres. So what farmers are saying is, well, if you have 7 or 8 of these in a commonage, suddenly you have a massive chunk gone out of the commonage, so then it's going to really devalue the payments available to the farmer. And as well, it's going to knock the hell out of his score. So they're asking, well, why was it 100 metres when if you go and you look at the buffer zones that are around, riparian margins or stuff like that, are generally 2.5 metres, at most 5 metres. So now that the science behind it, they say, is that because of the actions of cutting turf, you dry out the bog all around it. But as one farmer said to me, he said, how can you dry out an area that's higher than the section of bog you're cutting out? He said, surely it's the area below it. So they're saying that this 100 metres was just an arbitrary figure that was plucked out of the sky, but that farmers are going to lose money because of it. And they say there's no science to back it up. Now, the word on the ground is that there's unlikely to be a budge on this from the department, but it's a real issue of contention, and fellas are fairly fired up about it.
Yeah, it is a very practical issue. Sometimes when we're looking through these schemes, when it's just on the paper in black and white, a figure like that 100 meters might seem fine, or it might seem fine for department officials, but then when you apply it to practical cases, like you mentioned, if there's 13 or 14, there's 13 or 14 kind of turbine cutting plots scattered throughout the bog, and there's 100 meters around all of them. Your big kind of swipe of commonage can get small very, very quickly, and this, of course, will impact payments under the scheme.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
So I will move to you now, Rachel. You were down at the Irish Farmers Journal's Tullamore Farm on Thursday. There was an AgriAware Farm Walk and Talk event on, with secondary school students having a look around and, I suppose, hearing a bit about the farm. But you were talking to ag science teachers down there, and they had a bit to say on the Leaving Cert ag science course and the way that it's structured. I suppose, what were the criticisms that were coming up, or what did they have to say on student numbers?
Yeah, so I spoke to four different ag science teachers, Noel, last Thursday, and they were all, I suppose, shared quite a negative view of the new ag science course, and as a result, numbers have, I suppose, dropped. Students are kind of looking at the new project in particular, Noel, and they're saying that looks a lot harder than the old project. Which I suppose yourself and myself would have done, where you compile a big folder and it's kind of a case study on your own farm. And if you don't have a farm yourself, you do a case study on someone else's farm. Whereas now it's a kind of a scientific experiment, and it's done on a laptop, so it's done virtually. I suppose one of the bones of contention that teachers had was that it's very hard to screen who's actually doing it. So is the student doing it? It's him, they're themselves, or are they getting someone down the road to do it? Or are they getting an older brother or sister to do it for them? The other thing was that a couple of teachers mentioned to me is that the it's very hard to get a H1 or an H1 in the new terms in ag science. And I think that's turning a lot of students away, and it's just they just don't seem to be giving out H1s. And as one teacher said, it just baffles her every year that there's H1s in biology and other science courses, and they're just not as free to give it to ag science. So maybe there's students, whereas once upon a time ag science would have been looked upon as an easy subject to take if you had any knowledge of farming, but it just doesn't seem that the A's just don't seem to be handed out as freely for ag science as it is other courses or other subjects.
That definitely could have a role to play. And then, very briefly, you have a bit on the fertilizer trade this week. And I suppose, rather than looking at prices, you kind of had a look at the flow of product into farmers' yards and how different products are moving around. What's the update there?
Yeah, so basically, Noel, in a nutshell, there has never been as little farm fertilizer in farmers' yards, and there has never been as little interest from farmers to buy fertilizer. So they're kind of it seems to be kind of a waiting game. But the merchants and co-ops are nervous that hauliers are going to come under severe pressure. I think it happened in around 2019 when farmers waited like this until about the 18th or 19th of March, and then everyone moved. You know how farmers work. They see their neighbour sweating a bit of fertilizer, getting a delivery into the yard, and then it'll remind them to ring their co-op. But the issue here, Noel, is that once farmers decide to look for their fertilizer, they won't be getting it for 10 days or 2 weeks afterwards. That's kind of the warning here, is to get your orders in now, and don't be looking for your fertilizer and expecting it the next day, because you will be waiting 10 days or two weeks for it to come. And that's just because, you know, there's figures there to back it up. The department, I had it in the paper last week. The department figures show that 83% less fertilizer sales took place between October and December. So this is the first quarter of the fertilizer trading season. And I know, like, that's obviously not when farmers are spreading fertilizer, but a lot of farmers would forward buy and forward purchase fertilizer during this time. And the other figure then is by the end of February, by the end of February, generally a quarter of all fertilizer is sold. And so far, only 6 or 7% of fertilizer has been shifted to both farmers' yards and merchants' yards to date. So seems to be a big backlog there, and I suppose that is the warning there, Noel, that farmers should get their orders in if they want it.
Definitely, I'd say if we see a good week or two of weather, that could turn around fairly quickly, and we could be looking at the opposite kind of scenario with fertilizer flying out of the places. But anyways, I'd say we'll leave it there for this week. We had quite a bit covered off. And first of all, we'd like to thank you, the listeners, for tuning into this week's episode of the Irish Farmers Journal Farming News Podcast. But also, don't forget to pick up your copy of this week's paper to read further on the stories that we've covered off and lots, lots more.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.